On Thursday, history was made with President Joe Biden signing a $1.9 trillion stimulus bill.
This historic legislation is about rebuilding the backbone of this country and giving people in this nation, working people, middle-class folks, people who built the country, a fighting chance.
The stimulus package, called the American Rescue Plan, is intended to alleviate the brutal effects of the COVID-19 pandemic and the economic crisis. And as we discussed earlier this week, aside from stimulus checks, it carries with it major changes, including child tax credits and aid to local and state governments. No Republican voted in favor of the bill. But that's not the only piece of news coming from D.C. Lawmakers are also looking at other blockbuster legislation, including a new voting rights bill. And at the same time, the Justice Department continues to release information on the major players leading the January 6th Capitol riot. Not only that, but we're seeing movement on Biden administration officials' confirmations, including Marsha Fudge's confirmation for housing secretary this week. There's a lot happening in D.C. right now. I'm Matt Katz, and breaking down developments in Washington is where we start today on The Takeaway. I'm joined now by three journalists who have their ears to the ground on all things politics. Perry Bacon Jr., senior writer for 538, Maya King, politics reporter at Politico, and Nick Fandos, congressional correspondent for The New York Times. Hey, guys. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Hey.
All right. So, Nick, let's start with the big, big news of the week, nearly $2 trillion stimulus bill. Can you just break down a bit how Americans' lives are going to be affected by this? Like, if you were to explain this to someone who hasn't read the bill or followed politics in the last few weeks, what would you tell them about it?
Sure. Well, this is just a staggering amount of money on top of, you know, $4 trillion that Congress had already spent basically in the last year to address the coronavirus crisis. I'd say, you know, there's a set of short-term and longer-term provisions in here that are probably going to end up affecting Americans' lives. You know, the most immediate one is a lot of people are going to be getting another round of direct checks from the government. This time, you know, up to $1,400 and more if you're, you know, have kids and meet certain income thresholds. You know, that's a lot of money that could be showing up in the next few weeks. If you're unemployed, there is a significant extension of a federal unemployment benefit, which was put in place, you know, for the first time about a year ago. It'll be $300 a week on top of whatever your state gives you. For, you know, if you're living in a state or a city with a big budget deficit that's looking at cutting services, they're probably going to get an infusion of cash from this bill. If you're a small business owner, this helps firm up the PPP small business loan program. There's money for all kinds of different industries, restaurant industry, airlines. And more money for vaccines and schools to try and get them in people's arms and get schools open as quickly as possible. So that portion, I think, is really about trying to bridge the last portion of this crisis. And then there's a set of longer term policies, which, you know, Democrats have been advocating for a long time and finally had a chance to advance in this bill. The most significant one, which you alluded to just a minute ago, is a big expansion of the child tax credit, which, you know, experts estimate could alleviate child poverty by as much as 50%. So, you know, a lot of, in fact, most American parents are going to start seeing this year, I think about a $300 check per kid showing up each month. That's money in their pocket that they can choose to do with what they want. And then there's kind of a host of other provisions that will have a long life, probably and hopefully longer than the pandemic.
Maya, I want to ask about one thing that Nick mentioned, the aid to local and state governments. It seems to me that that's potentially a big deal. Like, there have been huge deficits in local governments due to tax revenue shortfalls from the pandemic. So, I mean, does this mean that like teacher layoffs that would have happened won't happen and that roads will get paved? Those kinds of things that people wouldn't necessarily realize is coming from this relief package?
Well, it's interesting that you would mention roads getting paved. I think infrastructure has been front of mind for a number of right. voters and political reporters now for the last 4 years. And the thing that, you know, I think I'll be watching as it relates to how state and local governments really distribute this money is, of course, you know, how they're thinking about which communities will be able to benefit from it. I think at the forefront of a lot of these conversations are how schools will be funded and how a lot of these equity gaps will be filled by some of this funding. And we know that a number of low-income schools have really had a hard time being able to open and bring kids back because in part, they just haven't had the infrastructure in place to be able to do so healthily. I think also this aid to state and local governments has opened a very interesting and unusual opportunity for bipartisanship. We've seen a number of mayors and state leaders who are Republicans come forward and say, you know, actually, we really do need this money. We support this legislation and we'd like to see this funding come to us as soon as possible because a lot of these municipalities have really taken just a major beating as a yeah. result of the virus. And so that's also something I think that, you know, will have some long term effects, particularly in these larger cities across the country.
Perry, what does the passage of this bill tell us about how Washington is going to work under a Biden administration? You wrote that this bill indicates that this Democratic Party that's in power right now is governing more to the left than in previous years. And I'm curious why we're seeing such a significant course correction from the Trump era. Is it the influence of stars like Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, or is it the protests from last year, or just maybe the pandemic and the public's desire for more government assistance due to COVID? Why do you think that is? Why are we seeing such a kind of a leftward tilt?
So the answer is probably all of the above a little bit, but I mean, just to put this in context, I guess, I mean, the one thing that's worth with this bill is the 2009 stimulus was $787 billion, which is about $940 billion in today's dollars. This mm-hmm. bill at $1.9 trillion is more than double that. You could argue in some ways that the crisis is worse, but I'm not sure it's two times as bad as the crisis of 2009, 2008 was. So it just goes to the point that, and also this revision has bills things in it that I think that the Bill Clinton or Barack Obama Democratic parties would not have done. We're talking about, if you think about these tax credits for children, these child tax credits, as well as the direct checks, we're talking about, you know, families getting $7,000 or more a family of four than they would have otherwise had. So $7,000 in a year they wouldn't have had from a single bill, direct money to them is just something that we were not seeing from past Democratic administrations. And I'd say there were three reasons. First of all, I think that, yes, I think the party, you know, Joe Biden is a moderate person, more moderate than Senator Warren or Senator Sanders or AOC. But throughout his career, Biden has tried to position himself in the center of where the Democratic Party is. And I would argue that center has moved left because of those leftward figures that I'm talking about. So AOC, Warren, et cetera. So that's part of it is the party is just more left. But I also mm-hmm. think that the crises of 2020, I think, in some ways changed politics. And I'd say COVID was obviously changed the economy, resulting in so many people being unemployed. It sort of exposed a lot of the problems that the economy already had in terms of inequality. So I think that made everybody, you know, Mitt Romney is also proposing more liberal ideas than he proposed before, and he's a Republican. So I think I think the actual conditions on the ground also have dramatically changed where people are. And I think that the protests did too. You saw a movement of people really talking about the idea that that America is not working for them. The COVID deaths, I think, a lot of the talk about inequality that happened was happening during the 2020 primary and seemed real, but not necessarily in your face. COVID, the COVID deaths, the George Floyd protests, put those things really in people's faces and in the news all the time. And I think that affected how Biden governed. I don't think I would have imagined Biden would have signed this kind of bill even a year ago, maybe not even 6 months ago. And the third thing being that I think that I think that January 6th in a lot of ways changed the Democratic Party in the sense that I think, and the reaction to it, I think that there was a sense from Biden and a lot of other Democrats that, you know, the fever of Trump will kind of go away. We can sort of work with the more moderate Republicans. And I think that January 6th, what happened that day, combined with the Republican Party kind of having an internal discussion and then kind of going back to Trumpism and basically rejecting the idea that, you know, the Republican Party has sort of come back to be aligned with Trump. And I think that has convinced a lot of Democrats, okay, there's no need to, we can't really work with them. If you watch this whole process, Biden and his staff sort of pretended to be bipartisan. They had meetings, they had discussions, but there was no real sense that they were really trying to get Republicans to vote for this bill, nor was there a real sense, in my view, the Republicans on the Hill were ever going to vote for this bill. So you saw, so I just think the Democratic Party in 2009 and 2010 with Obama was very focused on bipartisanship. And I think that they've decided that's not possible, and why bother to some extent now.
Interesting. Nick, the conditions on the ground that Perry spoke of, even though there was no bipartisan support for this bill, the public, there's bipartisan public support for this, at least in general, stimulus legislation. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, public polling has been pretty consistent over the last several weeks and around its passage in the last week that, you know, the public is by and large on board with the broad strokes of this bill, including people who identify as Republican voters. Now, I think that Republican politicians seem to be a little bit split between thinking, you know, yes, there are popular provisions in here, but there's a lot of ones that we can educate the public on that will be seen as excesses or too radical on the part of the Democrats. And, you know, this bill's popularity will wane over time in the way that the, you know, bailout 10 years ago or so did. But, you know, at the same time, we've also seen Republicans, you know, pretty aggressively try and pivot. There's a lot of talk this week on Capitol Hill from Republicans about the situation at the southern border, where there's been an increase in migrants and a real kind of overwhelming of government systems down there. And Republicans seem far more eager to talk about that particular crisis, as they label it, than the pandemic at this point. So we'll have to see going forward which path they pick. And I think, you know, which one may determine how popular this stuff remains, or maybe it'll be the other way around and they just won't be able to dent this bill and they'll move on to other things.
Maya, something called the Equality Act recently passed the House, which would bar discrimination on the basis of gender identity and sexual orientation. Can you tell us who that bill is geared for?
Yeah, so this legislation is very much in line with the Biden administration's commitment to equity. And I think that Congress and congressional Democrats have sort of taken that charge and making sure that this is something that that follows also with their legislation. And so this is something that would bar, as you said, the discrimination on the basis of gender and would open up more opportunities for those, I think, in the past who have struggled to break through. And this is something that the Biden administration has really prioritized and will, of course, be pushing through, I think, in Congress in the coming weeks.
Then there's also a couple of gun control bills that the House approved. Perry, I'm wondering if this is doomed in the Senate, and then if that's indicative of other bills that are going to go to the Senate over the next couple of years and only to die because moderate Democrats kill them. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, the background checks bill was passed by the Democrats in the last House, in the House Democrats last time too, in 2019, I'm pretty sure, and also moved nowhere. We're headed toward this big fight, and this week we saw what I think is the biggest illustration of it and where it's going to become most central, which is that you have basically three blocks of Democrats. You have sort of the most sort of leftward Democrats want to get rid of the filibuster and like add judges to the Supreme Court and just to do a lot of like really liberal things by getting rid of the filibuster. You have the Joe Manchins and the Kristen Sinemas, the senators who are opposed to getting rid of the filibuster. But you saw this week what I think is an emerging position among Democrats, which James Clyburn and Stacey Abrams both raised. They're two of the most prominent Black figures in the party, which is that you shouldn't get rid of the filibuster for everything, but you really need to get rid of the filibuster so you can pass voting rights bills that protect particularly people of color's right to vote and the ability to vote, particularly in response to all these bills moving in states like Georgia that would make it harder to vote. So I think the filibuster fight is going to be about a lot of issues, but it's really going to be about these voting rights issues where you're going to see a lot of like Black Democrats pressuring Manchin and Sinema particularly and saying, you know, on some level, you may want the filibuster in theory, but you cannot prioritize the filibuster over Black voting rights. That's where we're headed toward, is going to be this real fight in the next few months in the Democratic Party. And Biden so far has tried to say, his staff's been saying his preference is to keep the filibuster. You know, people have lots of preferences in life that they don't necessarily abide by. And I think he's signaling maybe some openness to some changes on an issue himself.
Nick, it was just over 2 months ago, believe it or not, that violent insurrectionists stormed the Capitol, and the FBI is continuing its investigations. They announced more arrests this week. Has this crazy thing that happened been largely forgotten, with Capitol Hill just back to business as usual, or is it still centering the conversations that you're having with sources?
I wouldn't say it is the center of all conversations. I mean, this conversation has made evident Congress is very busy. But it really is in the background of quite a lot of things. And, you know, going to work, you know, thousands of people that go to work in the Capitol every day can't escape it. I mean, the building is surrounded by a fence and razor wire. There's still thousands of National Guard troops on patrol every day. I mean, that kind of sets a tone. And frankly, I think, you know, there is a real and palpable lack of goodwill and animosity between a lot of Republicans and Democrats, particularly in the House of Representatives, where, you know, there are a lot of Democrats who are basically refusing to work with Republicans who, even after the riot, voted to overturn certain election results in states that President Biden had won, saying they won't co-sponsor their legislation, they won't, you know, vote for their bills on the floor, they're going to try and ostracize them in hearings. You know, and Republicans, on the other hand, are pushing back and accusing Democrats of, you know, continuing to kind of nurse wounds over this for too long, saying they need to take the fence down, they need to get rid of the National Guard. They're blaming it somewhat quizzically on Speaker Pelosi, who does not have unilateral control over any of those things. So there's, you know, a lot of recrimination. There's also still investigations going on. They're trying to figure out how to put together an independent commission to look at what happened. And even that's been a subject of considerable partisan disagreement, you know, so much so that, you know, here we are a couple months later, and it's yet to be put together.
Nick just referred to the National Guardsmen hunkered down in the Capitol. I'm curious to get Perry and Maya to give me a quick lightning take about how the biggest way your life as a Washington reporter has changed in the post-Trump era. I mean, no more Trump tweets waking you up in the morning, I guess. But what else? Perry, can you give me a quick take on that?
I think that's that is a takeaway, though. In a certain way, is like the weekends and nights are not that they're, we have plenty of news happening, but it's much more predictable. Like Biden, you sort of know he's going to sign a bill on Friday. Apparently Biden has a Twitter account, but I have no idea what he says because the tweets, I assume, are quite boring because no one retweets them or tells him what they say. So I think that's the biggest change, is like things are more, there's a lot of news happening, but it's much more predictable and not, and so it's therefore sort of it's an easier job, candidate.
Right. My, tell me, is your life just much more chill now that a tweeting president is no longer in the White House?
It is. And it allows us to focus on some other storylines like the first dogs or even a reparations bill. I mean, it gives us an opportunity to focus on some stories that perhaps would not have at all been storylines under the Trump administration.
Perry Bacon Jr. is a senior writer for 538. Maya King, who we just heard from, is a politics reporter at Politico. And Nick Fandos is congressional correspondent for The New York Times. Guys, thank you all for joining us. Really appreciate it. Enjoy your weekends.
Thanks for having us.
You too.
The last 4 years was a heavy news cycle where stories seemed to be breaking every minute. Many of you were very engaged, but the election of President Joe Biden has seemed to slow the constant desire to watch and follow the news 24/7. We asked you how your engagement with politics has changed since Biden took office, and what stories are important to you now.
Hi, my name is Kat, and I live in Middletown, New Jersey. Since Biden took office, I would say that I've sort of taken a teeny break from being super engaged in the politics. I still listen to WNYC every day, just about, but I am very concerned still about the voting rights bill that's coming and how just polarized the Senate is. And my hope is for term limits, for goodness sakes.
Hello, my name's Jen. I'm from Austin, Texas. For me, my political engagement has not changed since Joe Biden took office. I've seen a lot of people pretending that everything is quote unquote normal again and just going back to brunch and ignoring everything that's going on around us. I think we have to hold Biden to account for the bad things that he has done, like refusing to fight for $15 an hour minimum wage, and for the bombing of Syria that it doesn't seem like has gotten very much attention at all. It's important that we stay engaged and fight for the things that we need. Thank you.
Hi, I've totally disconnected from anything political, from listening to the radio or TV, even my daily briefings. I might glance at it, but nothing like it was the last 4 years. I really needed a mental and emotional break from you know who. This is Diana from Miami, Florida. Thanks.
With Joe Biden in the White House, I've been following along more with actual legislation like H.R. 1 or For the People Act, and less concerned about drama and antics emanating from the White House. This is Doug in Portland, Oregon.
My news engagement has definitely changed since the Biden administration has been in office. I am not listening with a clenched jaw and tight shoulders. My stomach is not in a knot. I also don't feel the need to check in every hour to see what new disaster has taken place. I'm closely following social issues as well as the minimum wage discourse.
This is Josh from Philadelphia. Personally, I do have a greater sense of calm with the new administration. I'm a registered independent, but I do see a greater focus on achieving and accomplishing tasks at least one at a time. And I don't see a tendency to micromanage the world around the president in the same way that the previous administration did. So I do feel a lot better in general, and I see a positive impact on my community. Feels pretty good.
And listen, folks, sometimes you guys send us messages that we may need to interpret a little bit. Mia in Nashville responded about our political engagement question by sending us this.
I never thought that this would work out easy. I never thought that you would try to come please me. Sometimes I just get tired. But sometimes, oh, sometimes I just get tired.
That was lovely. Thank you, Mia, and thanks to all of you for chatting with us. Remember, you can always go to thetakeaway.org and click on Contact Us to leave your take, or you can send us a voice memo and email it to us at thetakeawaycallers@gmail.com. On Wednesday, Marcia Fudge was confirmed as Secretary of Housing and Urban Development in a bipartisan vote. She'll be the second Black woman in the role and the first in more than four decades.
I remember the feeling I had as a kid of the safety, security, and peace of mind contained in one word, home. I remember the comfort of knowing that no matter what happened, I could always go home. But far too many Americans live without that feeling.
As HUD Secretary, Fudge will not only inherit a housing crisis made worse by the COVID-19 pandemic, but also an agency in crisis. For more on this, we're joined now by Jerusalem Demsis, a reporter with Vox. Jerusalem, welcome back to the show.
Hi there. Nice to be here.
Let's start with some background on Marcia Fudge. How does her experience in government equip her for the new role at HUD?
So Marcia Fudge is a 12-year congresswoman. She's represented the Cleveland area in Ohio in Congress. And, you know, she hasn't particularly worked on housing issues in that role. But prior to being congresswoman, she was the first Black woman to lead a majority Black town as mayor in the Cleveland area. And in that role, obviously, all mayors have to deal with housing issues, with homelessness issues. And that's where the majority of her housing experience comes from. She was confirmed 6634. In a bipartisan vote by the Senate, which means, you know, there's reasonable confidence in her ability to do the role. But questions about her qualifications did come up during the confirmation process, mostly by Senate Republicans who feel not only that she does not have policy chops in housing to do the job, but also that, you know, she has made some statements in the past that have been critical of Senate Republicans, meaning that they feel like she's not going to be willing to listen to their policy ideas. I think the vote being so overwhelmingly bipartisan kind of belies the idea that she doesn't have support from both Republicans and Democrats in Congress. But I think it was a question of whether or not she's really focused on housing in the past. And, you know, prior to being nominated by Joe Biden to be the HUD secretary, she was actually gunning to become the Secretary of Agriculture, which is something she has focused on a lot in Congress. But, you know, she has seemed to take on this role, you know, during the confirmation process, seemed too excited to take on this role. And, you know, I think it's just up to seeing how well she can manage, you know, a large department, which is a big part of the job, is just management and ability to advocate for your department, both to the president and to Congress.
Right. You mentioned that the Republicans brought up some disparaging comments she has made about Republicans in the past. I was reading your story and my eyebrows raised over something she said last year, that Republicans, quote, don't even care a little bit about people of color. How did she explain that remark when she was asked about it during her confirmation hearing?
Yeah, so she made that comment when discussing police reform efforts in the Senate. And, you know, during her hearing, she said that she's willing to listen to any Republican who has ideas about how to improve the lives of people of color. But mostly she just kind of dodged the question. And, you know, it wasn't like other nominees such as Neera Tanden for OMB, where there was a concentrated attack on Republicans that she kind of waged for quite a while, and that Republicans were ready to kind of sink that nomination. With Fudge, you know, you could tell that some Republicans were upset about the remarks, but, you know, she has done enough bipartisan work. I mean, she has good friends. She's worked well across the aisle while in Congress, to the point that, you know, the 64-33 vote really just indicates that, you know, no one really believed that that was something that would hinder her from being able to work in a bipartisan manner.
At HUD, Secretary Fudge will have to deal with not just the housing crisis, which we'll talk about in a moment, but also an agency in crisis. The agency has shed many employees of late. Why has there been such a staffing exodus at HUD?
Yeah, so HUD has historically been underfunded. It is one of the departments that, you know, in general is working for, is working to improve the lives of marginalized communities, usually poorer Americans who need help getting housing, is the majority of the programs existing at HUD. And, you know, Republicans in general don't believe in using public housing as an approach towards helping people who need it at the lower end of the income ladder. They're, you know, more looking for market-based solutions. And so they've been hostile to HUD funding over years. And then on the side of Democrats, I mean, Democrats have been really scared to really prioritize HUD, because that would mean enforcing a lot of fair housing laws that are really controversial on the ground. It would mean making sure that cities and localities are not discriminating in how they're placing housing voucher recipients in poor areas, which is a really common way of separating them from the rest of the community. And that's just a really difficult conversation for folks to get into. And it's easier for presidents to kind of ignore it. Even under President Obama, HUD sustained budget cuts. I mean, every single Democratic president has really kind of ignored the responsibilities to the department. I think we're getting to the point right now where the housing crisis has ballooned out of control. It's no longer something that you can just say is affecting a less wealthy and Americans. It is something that is now affecting even people higher up on the income scale who are having difficulty finding housing in the places they want to live. And, you know, the affordability crisis in America's major cities and even in America's non-coastal cities is kind of getting to a point where the government's really going to have to step in. And I think that this is in a moment where all of America is going to be able to benefit if they choose to take it on through HUD, which is, you know, still not something that any president has ever done.
You said this housing crisis has been exacerbated of late. I imagine that's because of the pandemic. Are things just much worse in terms of people finding housing because of what we've experienced over the last year?
Yeah, I mean, so there are two facets to this. There are renters and homeowners. These folks have kind of experienced the crisis in two different ways. For renters, you know, the majority of people who have lost their jobs, who have sustained financial losses during the pandemic, have been renters. And, there are billions of back rent that have accrued. And there have been a lot of folks who've lost their homes and had to double up with other family members or even become homeless. And so that's a huge crisis, not only for the renters, but also for a lot of the small landlords that own these properties are not able to maintain, are not able to continue to operate them if they're not getting people's rent. And what that ends up happening is that they end up selling their units to private equity firms or other large corporations that then turn those into non-affordable housing units, which, you know, already exacerbates America's existing affordable housing stock. So that's one crisis. And then on the other side, when we're talking about homeowners, we've seen record low mortgage rates over the last year, which, you know, has made it really attractive for people to buy houses. People on the higher end of the income ladder have actually been able to save more money this year because, you know, they're staying home or they're not able to do as much as they used to be able to do, but their incomes haven't really taken a hit. And so for those folks, they've been trying to buy houses, but America's long-running supply issue where we're just not building enough homes where people want to live means that everyone is kind of bidding up like the same number of houses. And, it's kind of led to a point where we're seeing the highest price increase in memory among the America's housing stock. So people are also frustrated because they're not able to find homes that they want to live in. They're not able to buy homes where they want to live, and they're forced to kind of like take a cut in the types of amenities or things they want to buy. So it's really a two different crises, and also, of course, the homelessness crisis, where we've seen a lot of studies done that show that people who are homeless are not only more likely to get COVID and die of it, but also more likely to increase community transmission. I think that's the big thing here is that, COVID has shown us that it's, you can't just be worried about yourself. You have to be care about your community, and that public health means also housing. And, that's something where if this administration takes it seriously, they have a huge opportunity to make lives better.
The Biden administration has said that racial equity will be a guiding force for all policies, but specifically housing policy. What will Secretary Fudge prioritize in order to address that?
So there are a lot of things here, and I think that's a really good question because the way that Marcia Fudge has come at HUD is not from someone who has a lot of housing policy experience. She's coming at it from someone who has certain values about how she thinks that housing policy should be done. So she has really prioritized equitable housing policy during her confirmation hearing, and there are a lot of ways that this can be done. So firstly, Joe Biden has already put into motion the two different rules that were undone during the Trump administration that would make enforcing the Fair Housing Act a lot easier and also increase the amount of enforcement that HUD would be doing. And these two rules are ones that would enforce Fair Housing Act protections against race, color, national origin, religion, disability, sexual orientation, family status. And so I think these kinds of rules can do a lot. They're also extremely controversial. A lot of Republicans do not feel like these kinds of interventions from the federal government or that the courts should be able to force landlords to engage in this way, and that sometimes there's going to be a lot of federal overreach. But, that's one big thing that they've already started putting in motion, and Fudge is going to be instrumental in seeing how those rules are both designed and implemented. And then the second way is just, HUD runs tons of different programs. It runs programs for housing vouchers. It runs programs to send funding to mayors called community development block grants or other types of grants that just send tons of money to cities and localities in order for them to develop their communities. And so the administration of these programs obviously can be done in many different ways. One, it can be audited to make sure that people are really really engaging with using the money to ensure that their communities are equitable, or it can be used to segregate, which it has been done in the past, or it can be used to entrench inequality, which it has been done in the past. And Fudge has the opportunity here to make sure that the administration of these programs is truly equitable, which is something that, you know, HUD has usually not even had the staffing to do. And that's going to be a big challenge.
Jerusalem Demsis is a reporter with Vox. You know, Jerusalem, HUD is not an agency that many of us think about every day. So very glad you're on this story. Thanks for coming on The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Matt Katz, in for Tanzina Vega. Happy you could be here with us. And that's an interesting turn of phrase, right? Here with us? Because for so many of us, here with us has been a year-long abstract concept. And let's talk about that for a few minutes. This week marks 1 year since our team here at The Takeaway began working from home. For the most part, some of our crew has been working from the studio all along. That's Jay Cowett and Vince Fairchild, our control room crew. Jay's our director, Vince is our engineer. They both sound design the entire show. Say hi, guys.
Hi.
Hey.
They've been making the show together for nearly 13 years. Amazing, amazing work, gentlemen. We also had help from Board Ops Claire McKean, Debbie Daughtry, Sham Sundra, brave souls who traveled into an empty Manhattan for months to keep this show running. But for the most part, almost all of our producers, digital editors, assistants, interns, and our host, Tanzina, have been working from home remotely. And me too. I'm in my bedroom closet right now. I'm staring at an array of various colored pants that I used to wear. It never stops being weird. In fact, the show was cycling through 4 different hosts when the pandemic hit, as Tanzina was off for maternity leave. So it was an instant adventure. Our amazing, amazing engineering crew at WNYC gets a ton of credit for making it sound so smooth. Wayne Schulmeister, Alan Black, so many others. We've all experienced a lot over the last year, and we know you have too. And of course, we've learned things along the way about our work and ourselves. So we wanted to give our crew the floor for a little bit to talk about what it's meant to make The Takeaway and how to do it when we're all apart. Let's start with producer Ethan Oberman.
In the year since we've gone remote, a lot of my work as a producer has actually sort of stayed the same in terms of reaching out to guests and even editing audio from home. But what I don't think we've been able to recreate, unfortunately, is the experience of being able to turn to the other producers who sit next to me in the office and brainstorm ideas or react to breaking news. And that's what I've really missed the most.
Here's David Gable, our executive assistant and the chief mensch at The Takeaway.
I found the switch to working from home really difficult initially. Number one, I don't like change. Number two, it had to happen quickly. And number three, I'm old enough that I was really fearful of knowing how to do things remotely. I surprised myself that I used to be very fond of paper, and I have figured out how to do my job with little to no paper. And actually, it all goes faster. So certain things are fine. I really miss camaraderie and social energy. But truth be told, I get a lot done when I work remotely.
My name is Jackie Martin. I'm the line producer here for The Takeaway. I've been working from home for a year now. It's been challenging trying to produce a radio show from home. Communication is never good over the computer or Slack. I also have 2 daughters who are schooling from home and a husband who's also working from home. So having to keep them happy and fed 3 times a day and dealing with the dog and the house stuff while working has been difficult. But it's bittersweet because it's been nice actually being with them and spending more time than we ever have together. So I'm excited to get back to work, but I'll miss them a little.
producer Meg Dalton told us about some things I think a lot of you can relate to.
For me, the biggest change has been the blurred lines between home and work life and what that's meant for how we relate to one another. A deep level of empathy has become so necessary in the workplace as we all try to navigate different experiences of loss, pain, isolation, frustration, and so much more. We're all going through something collectively, but also individually too. Some of us have had to juggle childcare and other caregiving duties on top of putting together a daily news show. Others, including me, have lost friends or family members to COVID-19 or have even contracted the virus itself. Each of us is dealing with so much in our personal lives, and it's become really important to remember that day to day.
My name is Lydia McMullen-Laird, and I'm an associate producer for The Takeaway. My favorite part of the past year has been working remotely in different parts of the country. I want to give a special shout out to our listeners in Michigan, my home state. Even though our show is produced in New York City, we care so much about how this pandemic is affecting people all across the US and internationally, and I'm really glad I got to experience that and report on it. And also, working in sweatpants has been so awesome. I'm definitely not ready to transition back to hard pants.
I'm Amber Hall, senior producer here at The Takeaway. It's been a really weird year. In some ways, I can't believe it's already been a year, and in some ways, I can't believe it's only been a year. I used to complain about the back of my chair hitting the person who sat behind me, and, you know, our crowded newsroom, everyone talking on the phone made it hard to concentrate or hear your own conversations, but boy, to go back to those days, how nice it would be. I miss my colleagues. But doing this work has taught me a lot about adapting, and I know that we can produce a radio show from anywhere. I think we could do it from the moon.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
For some of us, like our sound designers, it's the little things.
So I'm at the studio. The only other person at the studio with me is Jay, the technical director. Everybody else, including the host, is working from home. And that means I can't see anybody else. Now, we have our Zoom meetings, and those are what they are, but that's only a very small part of the day. And sometimes I can't even go to those because I'm really busy with all the other production of the show. I can't see anybody else on the staff most of the time. And before the pandemic, I hated Slack. Now, this is how we communicate most of the time now. I'm dependent on Slack to have any kind of conversation with the people who are working from home. And this drives me crazy because it really slows down the conversation. I can't have the fluid conversation that I would have with somebody in person. So it just takes a lot longer to understand what somebody is saying. And I really can't wait to be back in person with the rest of my staff to have what feels like a more human conversation.
Every host has a different home, so every home has a different sound. And this is a hard thing to deal with, but it's kind of fun too. Certain hosts have noisy streets or are in airplane routes. Others have very noisy pets. Or like Tanzina, a very cute one-year-old baby who is very talkative. And all the guests have this now also, since all of them are home. And we've learned to embrace it and live with it because everyone has home noises. And I think our audience gets that as well. In some ways, it's a little more natural. People are at ease and these noises are part of our lives. So it kind of colors the sound a little bit, except birds. Oh man, birds are the worst. They're the worst broadcast animals. They're high-pitched, they're constant, they don't stop. Birds are just the worst. But other than birds, it's been really fun, and it's kind of been a nice learning experience for us and the tech crew.
Hi, my name is Polly Aringo. I'm the digital editor at The Takeaway, where I do all things digital and social for the show. I think the biggest challenge for me has been, how do I actually unplug from it all? You know, with my job, I'm, you know, online for my work. And so for me, it's like first thing I do in the morning is I pick up my phone like any of you. And then throughout the day, I'm also looking at a screen. And so how do I stop being glued to a device is what I'm working on. Because, you know, when you're at home, you're not able to turn to a coworker and say, hey, and chat with them. You're not able to walk around the office, not able to go to, you know, the coffee shop across the street. And so it's like I'm constantly staring at a screen. And so I'm just trying to figure out, you know, more ways to give my eyes a break. And so if you have any advice, any of the listeners out there, if you have any advice of how to, you know, stop being so glued to a device, feel free to reach out to me. I'm always curious.
Our executive producer, Lee Hill, has been reflecting on all of this. This guy has a pretty impossible task keeping us all together.
One of the more challenging things about working remotely was, one, the speed at which we had to move. I was in executive meetings and was told, you know, basically this needs to happen and it needs to happen very soon. And so very swiftly we moved to broadcasting from home and producing from home. And it has also been a challenge, I will say personally, to lead from a distance. I feel like I'm a much more in your face and leader from up close and close proximity. So leading over Zoom and keeping people motivated and keeping us focused on our North Star, which is to bring you the information and stories that help you understand the world better, has been tough, but so proud of the team for rising to the occasion.
And of course, Tanzina Vega, who spent the early part of the year raising her newborn before entering into remote hosting full-time, is seeing things from a very different perspective.
It's been almost a year, and I've been hosting The Takeaway from a coat closet surrounded by shoes and winter coats and hats and gloves and other things that I look at every day, and I've tried to create an environment in the closet that is reminiscent of our studio in New York, with a collage on the wall and some fun things to look at. And I've found ways to have my coffee and to sometimes grab some breakfast while in the closet and remain able to host the show while I also have my one-year-old on the other side of the closet door. On the one hand, I'm grateful to have had the space, even if it's a closet, to be able to work from. On the other hand, I miss seeing people in real life. I miss seeing guests in the studio. I missed interviewing folks in person. And I miss the daily interactions that are so important to journalism, which is so much a team sport. But I'm very grateful to my crew at The Takeaway for finding ways, whether it's through Zoom or other technologies, for us to stay afloat. And I'm also deeply grateful to my closet for somehow allowing itself to be converted into a radio recording booth. So we'll see how things turn out in the upcoming year, but so far, this is how we're doing the show.
I'm floored by how Tanzina and the team have worked to tell us the news day in and day out over the last year. There's an exhaustion that comes with telling these stories, some of them so tragic and difficult, and then turning away from all of that to make sure your kids are in school on their screens or eating their lunches or not making too much noise while your spouse is in a Zoom meeting with her boss, and all the while just remembering to check in on friends and elderly relatives to make sure they're okay. As for me, I'm a reporter by day, so I really miss being out on the field, interviewing strangers in person, learning new things the old school journalistic way. One day soon, I'll be back out there, and of course, I'll try to bring some of that reporting to this show. Anyway, we appreciate you spending your time here with us every day. It's not easy to be apart. The team misses drinks at the Brooklinaire Bar, but having you with us for part of your day is special too. And it keeps us going. Thanks for being part of this and talking with us every day too. I Almost exactly 1 year ago, several weeks into nationwide lockdowns, I was in the guest host chair for The Takeaway. And during that time of panic and uncertainty, we checked in with several comedians to see how they were adapting to life without live stand-up shows, and to find out where they were finding space for humor amid all of the grim news. 1 year later, we wanted to check back in with one of those guests.
Hello, I'm Roy Wood Jr., a correspondent with The Daily Show with Trevor Noah.
During the pandemic, Roy has been churning out segments for The Daily Show from home. Here he is talking with Trevor Noah right after the November election about whether he'll ever trust pollsters again.
I will try to predict elections again, only now I will be using more reliable predictions, like astrology or the reading the entrails of a guinea pig or like on the night of a full moon, going outside, urinating, seeing if my pee make any type of words or letters I can read, you know, some of that Ouija board.
Well, I mean, another option is you could always just try and talk to people of different communities and try and suss out their perspective of the world.
Yeah, I said talk to astrologists. That's what I said. You're not listening.
Now, while it's been a full year since he performed for an in-person audience, Roy is planning to do stand-up once again as early as this summer. But the excitement of getting back on the road is also bringing him some mixed emotions.
Comedy is an addiction, period, point blank. It is an addiction to adrenaline. And my buddy Neil Brennan said this, and I've never agreed with it more. There's got to be something wrong with your brain to walk into a room full of strangers and basically walk on stage and go, everybody be quiet. I've got something important to say. You know, I love it. You know, it's the rawest form of expression. But what makes me nervous about getting back out there is, number one, you have all these thoughts and opinions and jokes and perspectives that you want to delve into. But comedians don't have the luck. We're the one entertainment discipline that's created in front of the consumer. So you see our failures, you know? So when you have a joke that's kind of juggling dynamite in terms of the type of topics that you want to discuss, those failures in public now come at a potential penalty. And that was already in place before COVID.
Sure.
So now add on top of that, an audience at 50% well, not in Texas, they'd be packing them in, but coupled with that, audiences a little more spread out, people a little more paranoid, a cough in a room being the same as a gunshot. I'm very curious to see what people are thinking and feeling. And you know, my approach to this is the same as when you go into the ocean. You dip your toes in, so that's a few rooftop shows and outdoor shows in the city just to get the muscle of performing back. And then maybe you do one or two, you know, shows in the tri-state somewhere. And, you know, hopefully by, I don't know, summer or fall, depending on how this vaccine moves nationally. That's another thing I'm monitoring is the rollout. Then you start trying to get on the road a little bit, you know, and figure out air travel. Am I going to take the train everywhere? Like, am I only going to perform in train cities? Well, what are the logistics of just sitting on an Amtrak in a sleeper car every day? You know, so sure. I don't know. But, you know, how to do it is as important as just going out and doing it. And at some point, I've got to get back out there because that's still the essence of who I am, because stand-up is the one thing they cannot take from me. I can't get notes on it. You can't tell me it's over. All the comedians that are respected died with dates on the books. That's where you can't stop. It is an addiction.
Is part of the draw that brings you back every night to go back on stage the hearing the laughter? Because that's something you literally haven't heard live in a year. I mean, even The Daily Show, there's no making jokes, telling funny stories, doing amazing bits, and there's no studio audience. So is that something you really miss, just hearing like a room of strangers laughing?
I miss people. I really do. And I've done Zoom shows and the online shows, and those are cool, but it's not the same. It's just not the same as, you know, seeing and connecting with people. And at the end of the day, we're just all out here trying to make sure that we're not alone and feeling the way we feel. That's why we consume most media, because it touches us in some way. Yeah. So whether it's music or comedy or a concert or a film or whatever, I just think we're looking to satiate, you know, the need to feel. We all have a need to feel something. And, you know, comedy does that for me. And to do it one way for 23 years and then in the 24th year, yeah, there's not going to be any people. And it's like, nah, I got to get back out there at some point.
When you get back out there, are you going to miss Donald Trump at all? I mean, the political landscape is different now. No more Trump jokes, or I guess you could still talk about Trump, but the relevancy is gone. You had said, I read in Vulture, that you think Trump was good for comedy. Why, and what happens now?
I felt that Trump was good for comedy in the sense of pushing comedians to deeper places to talk about. Like, most of the Trump jokes are obvious, or were obvious. So I felt like that put us in a place of a creative boom. So of course there's more things to laugh about because we're all connected and we're all looking at this crazy thing. Trump is literally like a second sun coming up over the horizon. You cannot ignore that. We must have discussions about that. But for the people who choose not to, you had to immediately come up with more things and you had to be more in depth in terms of your content and what you were discussing. Because the Trump jokes, you know, a lot of that, it's surface. And it's also something that everyone has an opinion on. And I think it became more and more difficult with Trump to have a unique take on him that was long lasting, that could outlive his news cycle. So yeah. I felt like it's good in the sense that as a comic, you now have to figure out something. The only analogy I can make is that, you know, in late night television, and this is including our program as well, it's day to day. We're following what happened today or in the last 48 hours. And, you know, a lot of those jokes are about the weather. Whereas to me, good stand up is about the climate. And with Trump, it was difficult to find jokes about the climate because you were still in the middle of the hurricane. But the comics who could, I think you get rewarded.
Yeah.
You know, it's something that's more touching. That's also why I love being a correspondent, because Trevor can carry the weather just fine. And he can give you new prisms through which to look at these things that are currently happening and give you the prognostication of the future. Whereas a correspondent, I get to go out and talk to the people who are ultimately affected by a lot of these policies that are discussed in the weather.
Interesting. So one part of the climate, particularly right now and always in America, racial justice and the uprisings that we saw last year, you were back home in Alabama during that, involved in attending some protests. What was that experience like? Did you take some time away from, you know, finding whatever the satire that could be gleaned from it and just give a moment to think about the gravity of where we were and where we are in America right now?
Well, that's what I went and I expected. But for me, the thing that really struck me was, and I can only speak, you know, to Birmingham, but what really struck me was how many people still care about one another, you know, across races. You know, the richest zip code, Mountain Brook, Alabama, which is the richest zip code in the state of Alabama. It's our Beverly Hills, if you will. You know, those people showed up on some George Floyd protesting, you know, taking knees with black people. And that's not something that would have happened in a place like Birmingham, hell, 4 years ago, let alone, you know, 2019. So, you know, there were a lot of moments, you know, there were a lot of people that came in with the riffraff and vandalized a lot of buildings downtown. You know, Birmingham was no different than most cities when, you know, things got unruly at night. But the next day, it was white people and black people coming together to clean up those respective businesses. It wasn't just black people. And so, you know, you're out there because you're angry, but then you cannot deny the facts when you see that people actually care about one another. It's like, wow. And it left me with a sense of hope for what could be, you know, because hopelessness is the default, you know, more often than not, especially if you're black, man. It's you got to dig deep to find that hope every day. So it was really cool to just see it in action, you know, while I was down there.
Also down in Alabama, you were raising money early in the quarantine for Stardome Comedy Club, and you were doing these Instagram fundraisers. What happened to Stardome? How's the club doing?
The club is still there. They were able to weather the storm. You know, I can't speak to whether or not they took a PPE loan or not, but I know that they got crafty, and this sounds odd to say, but I think part of what helped the Stardome is that they were in Alabama, and a lot of the shutdown orders came down much later in that state.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's also part of why a lot of states in the South are the ones that are coming back and, you know, we're open again. Well, you weren't closed as long as everybody else, so you still have a decent entertainment infrastructure there. Hmm. You know, so you know, couple that with a couple of, you know, the PP loans like that, I think really helped them. But there's been a lot of good comedy clubs that bit the dust nationally. And, you know, with what Mike Birbiglia and I were doing at the time with the whole tip your waitstaff thing, we were just trying to raise money for the waitresses who got laid off. We never thought the club would close. Even within COVID in those early days, in that April window.
Right.
Oh, the club is closed for the summer and the staff is laid off. Oh, get the staff a couple bucks till the club opens back up in July, in August. Even within COVID, like as a rainstorm was coming in, we still didn't know that it was a Cat 5 hurricane, but a Cat 8 hurricane coming behind that. You know, it just, we did everything we could for, you know, a number of clubs. I think it was close to a quarter mil. I know we touched 200.
That's great.
I know we touched 200K totally for, you know, for all the comedy clubs and the wait staffs that we were trying to get money for. But
I mean, the comedy scene's going to look a lot different, right? I mean, once this is all said and done, I mean, if all these clubs are closed.
For as long as you have people who want to perform and people who want to listen to performers, the rest of it will figure itself out. I think in the smaller, you know, B and C markets where clubs have closed, you're going to see a different type of venue for comedy. I think that'll be the main thing, is that I think the places where comedy occurs might be a little different. You know, New York's and Nashville's and all, you know, those places are going to be fine. But, you know, when I think about a club like the Comedy Showcase in Lansing, Michigan, that one's on the bubble. That one's on the bubble. Yeah. Jukebox Comedy Club in Peoria. That thing is an institution going back to the early 90s. Like Sam Kinison touched that same stage. Richard Pryor from Peoria touched that stage. So it's those spots. And from those places, that's where your next performers are coming. That's where they learned. So, you know, comedy might have to move back to the bars. I think it's going to be a little bit more of a speakeasy situation, because I think comedy's going to be in the same bucket as music, where until the larger venues open to do something, the bars that are just now coming back online are going to need a reason to get people in there. Mm-hmm. And the comedians need to go to a place where there's going to be people. So that might be your happy marriage. So I think we might be more dependent upon, you know, some hybrid use facilities going forward. But, you know, it's hard to say. And, you know, it's definitely tougher to say now than it was in, you know, March or April when the entire country shut down, where now, you know, you have clubs pretty much, I call it the SEC in the Big 12, like clubs down in that region, you know, the lower half of, you know, the 48, they're going to be doing better than clubs, you know, in other parts of the country. But some of those clubs are connected to chains. So maybe they can move money around, you know, in a sexy way that helps, you know, keep things in motion.
To step away from the clubs into the studio for a moment, you've got a new podcast coming out next week. Some people baked sourdough during the pandemic. Everyone else got a podcast, it seems. Tell us about the new show. What's it about?
Roy's Job Fair is essentially the idea came when the unemployment number hit, I think it was 30 million at one point in this country. It was like 30 million Americans that were out of work. I was trying to figure out a way to have a conversation every week with real people just about their work. And so what it kind of turned into, you know, originally it was just, all right, we're just going to talk job openings and give people ideas of where to pivot. And that's part of the show. But ultimately, it's just sharing conversations with people who either love their boss, hate their boss, you're looking for a boss, or you're trying to be your own boss. Pretty much all of us fall into one of those four quadrants.
Right.
I mean, honestly, and I hate to say it like this, but it's true. Work is like sex. Like, you're either getting enough or you need to get a little more. And if you're not getting any, you're looking for it. And so, you know, this podcast, you know, I think the desire to provide and to also seek fulfillment through how you provide for yourself and for your family, I think it's something that connects us. And if it connects us, there's going to be jokes. So we're just having funny, real conversations with people. I'm literally just talking to random strangers, myself and my co-host. You know, if you hate your job, this is a place to come. Let's talk about it. You know, if you love your job, we'll hear that too. Yeah, and hopefully somewhere in there, people get ideas about where to work and what they want to do by talking to people, not just like small business owners who are hiring, but, you know, we got people from major Fortune 500 companies that are calling in as well and just discussing career opportunities.
Wow. So blue collar jobs, white collar jobs, everything in between you'll touch on.
Literally everything. Like, I'm like, there's a strip club in Tampa that's hiring, but there's also a rideshare company that's hiring for coders. Put them in the same episode.
Yeah.
Why not? Let's explore that world and just find out more about people and what they do for a living and what drives them. You know, this isn't like employment listings, the podcast. Like, this is just a conversation about jobs. It connects us the same as food, the same as relationships.
Roy Wood Jr. is a comedian and correspondent for The Daily Show with Trevor Noah. And his new podcast is Roy's Job Fair. Get it wherever you get your pods. Roy, thank you so much for coming back on. Hopefully we are not speaking again a year from now because we're still in a pandemic.
Well, if we are, I'll have another podcast. I'll talk about that.
Great. Looking forward to it.
All right. Thank you.
Hey everyone, been a great week. Love hanging out with you on The Takeaway. Follow me on Twitter. I'm at MattKatz00, MattKatz00. I'll be around reporting from WNYC as usual, so you can hit me up there. Quick shout out to the team that makes this audio extravaganza every week for you out there. Polly Arungu is our digital editor. Vince Fairchild is our broadcast engineer. Jake Howitt is our director and sound designer. Our line producers are Jackie Martin and Jose Olivares. Our producers are Ethan Oberman, Meg Dalton, Patricia Jacob, and Lydia McMullen-Laird. Amber Hall is our senior producer, and Lee Hill is our executive producer. David Gable is our executive assistant. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Matt Katz, and this is The Takeaway. See you soon.